This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa
وَهُوَ الْعَلِيُّ الْعَظِيمُ.
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is he that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Senior federal and state election officials say there is no evidence that votes were lost or changed or voting systems corrupted in the U.S. 2020 presidential race. The top U.S. cybersecurity official says he expects the White House to fire him amid a dispute over the outcome of the recent election. World Health Organization member states condemn Israeli treatment of Palestinians, including COVID-19 patients. Thank you very much for joining us. U.S. officials have rejected claims of election fraud in the 2020 presidential election. Senior federal and state election officials said on Thursday that there is no evidence that votes were lost or changed or voting systems corrupted. They added that there are many unfounded claims for misinformation about the process of elections. The officials rejected allegations made by President Donald Trump and Republicans that fraud and lost ballots led to his loss. The developments come after Trump retweeted a claim that an election equipment maker, quote, deleted 2.7 million votes for him nationwide and switched hundreds of thousands of his votes to Biden in Pennsylvania and other states. Trump's campaign has filed lawsuits to challenge the results of the election announced by U.S. media that projected Joe Biden's victory. Brian Downing is a national security analyst, and he joins us now. Brown, welcome. Where do you stand on all this?
Well, I would like to see the political processes go through. Trump is entitled to make his claims in court. There will be recounts in some states, but his bolder, more daring, more unbased in fact claims simply cannot go on with a democratic system. You're hearing more and more conservatives speak out against Trump and his supporters on this. Some of the media have turned on him as well. For example, Fox used to be considered, you know, the Trump network, but I think it's pretty clear over the last few months that there's at least some important parts of that network that are opposed to Trump. They feel he's bad for the country and that he's bad for conservatism. I'm inclined to think that Trump will stop all this charade, this theater. He may just be doing this to promote himself for next year after he leaves office. That is, he will be have a media empire of his own, perhaps one of his own creation, and he will lead a political movement, which he's certainly entitled to do. I think there would be the concern that this movement of Trump's would be anti-democratic and perhaps moving in the way of demanding autonomy for conservative parts of the country. We'll have to see how that plays out.
So you feel that Trump's claims are unsubstantiated, Brian. What about the Republicans? How do you see them react? Their reaction to this?
Well, I don't have numbers right at hand, but more and more are speaking out against Trump and his claims. They realize, as perhaps does Fox, that Trump and his claims are bad for the country and bad for conservatism. I expect that he will drop this. Supposedly his, maybe not soon, but I think say by mid-December or late December, well before January 20th, or even around the time the Electoral College meets in December. And as I said, I think he will be planning his next move, which will be a media and political movement. He's very bad for the country. He's very bad for conservatism. He's bad for democracy.
Finally, Brian, there is a small but growing number of Republicans, as you indicate, that are backing calls for President Trump to concede power. Why do you think Republicans, some of them, are holding back?
Because they know that a very large part of their voter base is solid Trump land, and that they don't want to speak out against him for fear of having them turn on him or her. And there's the potential for violence, too, against any of these politicians, really. Happily, that has not happened. I actually thought there would be more fighting at the polls. I thought there might have been more violence in the aftermath as network after network, news agency after news agency declared Biden the winner. That hasn't happened. That doesn't mean it won't happen, but frankly, I'm a little more optimistic than I was 2 weeks ago.
Okay, great stuff. Brian, thank you very much indeed for your thoughts. Brian Downing, the national security analyst, joining us out of Florida. Also in the U.S., more Republican lawmakers are calling on the Trump administration to stop blocking Joe Biden's access to intelligence briefings. The lawmakers include Senator Lindsey Graham, who is a key ally of President Donald Trump. The call by those Republican lawmakers is seen as a tacit acknowledgement that Democrat Joe Biden will soon occupy the White House. That comes as Trump keeps refusing to concede defeat in the November 3rd presidential election. He says he has lost the vote due to electoral fraud. Most Republican officials and lawmakers support Trump's claims and say he has the right to challenge the election's results. Top U.S. Cybersecurity official Christopher Krebs, meanwhile, has told his associates that he expects the White House to fire him. Krebs told his associates that his efforts to debunk election-related disinformation have angered the Donald Trump administration, while both Democrats and Republicans praised him for his handling of the 2020 elections. The director of the Department of Homeland Security, Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency said White House officials have repeatedly asked for removal or editing of content that rejected false election claims. Earlier, Brian Ware, assistant director of the agency's cybersecurity, resigned amid pressure from the White House. In other news, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has denounced the European Union for following what he called the U.S.'s cruel policy against his country.
The European Union is stuck to Donald Trump's tail and automatically follows his cruel, heartless, and failed policy against Venezuela. Today, they've launched an extension of criminal sanctions against the country. The European Union is stuck to Donald Trump's tail. The European Union is playing a shameful, outrageous, and sad role.
Maduro was speaking after the EU on Thursday extended sanctions against Venezuela to November next year. The measures maintain an arms and sales embargo on the country, among other things. The EU has accused Venezuela of violating human rights and undermining democracy. In recent years, the US has also imposed several rounds of sanctions against Maduro's government over the same accusations. Caracas says the measures are an attempt to oust President Maduro. In 2019, both the EU and the US backed opposition leader Juan Guaido's move to declare himself president. The World Health Organization condemns the Israeli regime for violating the health rights of Palestinians and Syrians living in the occupied Golan Heights. During an annual assembly, the majority of WHO member states voted in favor of a report condemning Israel. The report called on the regime to provide additional resources to help Palestinians and the Syrians living in the occupied Golan Heights. The Palestinian Authority's ambassador to the WHO said the regime prevented Palestinians, including COVID-19 patients, from receiving health care. The ambassador noted it was unfortunate that the situation of treatment of Palestinians had been politicized. The Israeli regime has also not relaxed its blockade of the Gaza Strip during the pandemic, barring much-needed medicine and food from reaching the enclave. Political analyst and rights activist Bruce Katz says Israel's violation of Palestinian health rights is an example of its colonial oppression.
The care of people living under occupation in the Golan Heights is the responsibility of Israel. Obviously, it's not living up to its responsibilities. But again, this is the narrative of basically of colonial oppression and the subjugation of indigenous populations. In this case, it's during the pandemic. It should also be noted that only just recently, some days ago, and it was on the same day as the election in the United States, Israel completely razed a Bedouin village in the in the West Bank to the ground. Again, this is a crime against humanity at any point in time, but especially during a pandemic, it's even worse, even more brutal. So why should we expect that it would be any different for Palestinians in the Golan Heights? This is quite simply the ramifications of an apartheid regime that looks at the Palestinians as if they were something less than human.
Italy has ignored the European Parliament's resolution on an arms embargo on Saudi Arabia, Egypt and Turkey passed in mid-September. Italian arms have been exported to Saudi Arabia and to other members of the Saudi-led coalition waging war on Yemen. Max Civilli reports from Rome.
On September 17, a resolution issued by the European Parliament urged EU member states to impose an arms embargo on Saudi Arabia over the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the Yemen war. The resolution also contained an arms embargo on Cairo and Ankara, motivated by concerns Europeans' arms and military equipment might be used for internal repression in Egypt, and that Turkey's conduct in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea would run counter to the sovereignty of any EU member state. While some EU countries such as Germany, Finland and Denmark have adopted restrictions on the arms exports to Riyadh, Italy and other EU nations have ignored the resolution in full so far.
It's unacceptable that Egypt, a country known for human rights abuses, is the top importer of Italian weapons across the world. Saudi Arabia follows. We can't accept that countries involved in wars continue to receive our military equipment. Unfortunately, Italy hasn't done much since the EU Parliament adopted the resolution.
An Italian government report has found that the Unit for the Authorizations of Armament Materials green-lighted 57 times last year the supply of military systems, including bombs, torpedoes, rocket launchers and missiles, worth about 200 million euros to Saudi Arabia and UAE.
One in four arms sold worldwide in 2019 were produced in Europe, according to a report by CIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. France and Germany topped the list of European countries that trade in arms, while Italy came third.
We often look at the US as the main arms supplier worldwide. However, we forget that Europe also plays a major role. If the European Parliament only issues resolutions and not directives, all those countries not observing arms embargo cannot be sanctioned. Furthermore, there is a lack of political will among EU countries for change. European companies even compete with one another to sell more arms in conflicting countries.
Consecutive Italian governments have also ignored a domestic law passed in 1990 which bans the exports of weapons in countries in a state of war. Italy's arms exports stood at over 5 billion euros in 2019. Max Civili, Rome.
Turning to other news, results from Myanmar's parliamentary elections show that the ruling party, headed by Aung San Suu Kyi, has won enough seats to form the next government. Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy has secured 346 seats. That's well above the 322 threshold needed to win a majority. The EU and Britain have hailed Myanmar for the vote, but they have criticized the country for refusing to allow Rohingya Muslims to participate in the election. The minority population is denied citizenship despite the fact that they have lived in Myanmar for generations. Tens of thousands of Rohingya Muslims have been killed or forced to flee their homes in the past several years due to attacks by the army or Buddhist mobs.
Rohingya Muslims, a long maltreated group who is denied citizenship at home in Myanmar. They began fleeing their homes in Rakhine State after waves of attacks by Myanmar's army and Buddhist mobs. A citizenship law in 1982 stripped them of their nationality, making them one of the world's largest stateless communities. While there have been waves of migrations to Bangladesh since the 1970s, none was as rapid and massive as the one in August 2017 that turned the spotlight on the Rohingya crisis around the world. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims were violently uprooted in the months that followed, driven by a brutal military crackdown that killed thousands of them. What happened in August 2017 was so horrific that the United Nations calls it genocide and a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Over 700,000 Rohingya fled to Bangladesh. Thousands more sought refuge in India and other neighboring countries. Those who survived tell stories of burning villages, murder, rape, and babies being thrown into fires. Myanmar's military officials claimed that what happened to the villages were a counter-offensive aimed at uprooting terrorism. But the United Nations slammed the army's actions as clearly disproportionate and without regard for basic principles of international law. Today, Bangladesh alone is home to nearly a million Rohingya refugees. At least half of those who arrived in the country were children. These people now live in cramped temporary housing in the district of Cox's Bazar, waiting for a day to return home. The Rohingya want justice, They want those who committed the crimes against them to be held accountable. Myanmar's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, has been accused of failing to protect the minority group. Suu Kyi even rejected a UN report about the military's violence and defended her government's actions in the Rakhine State.
Myanmar requests the court to remove the case from its list. In the alternative, to reject the request for the indication of provisional measures submitted by the Gambia.
There were also talks of Rohingya repatriation, which never happened. Firstly, because Myanmar's government is unwilling to accept the refugees. And secondly, due to Rohingya Muslims fearing for their safety if they returned to their country. A UN fact-finding mission in Myanmar says approximately 600,000 Rohingya are still inside the country, living under the threat of genocide. Given Myanmar's leaders' reluctance to address the issue, the minority group's fate is a major cause for concern that is only being voiced by a selected group of countries around the world.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kHz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kHz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
On Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him. and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight. Donald Trump has no intention of admitting defeat in the U.S. presidential election or offering Joe Biden his concession, his campaign insisted on Monday, 9th of November. That word is not even in our vocabulary right now, Jason Miller, a senior campaign advisor, told Fox Business Channel. Donald Trump has launched an array of lawsuits to press claims of electoral fraud and corruption, for which he has produced virtually no evidence. State officials say they're not aware of any significant irregularities. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist David Smith. The piece is titled, "Donald Trump Has No Intention of Conceding, Campaign Insists." Stay with us for more of David Smith's article. Donald Trump has no intention of admitting defeat in the U.S. presidential election or offering Joe Biden his concession, his campaign insisted on Monday, 9th of November. That word is not even in our vocabulary right now, Jason Miller, a senior campaign advisor, told Fox Business Channel. Trump launched an array of lawsuits to press claims of electoral fraud and corruption, for which he has produced virtually no evidence. state officials, meanwhile, say they are not aware of any significant irregularities in the voting. Joe Biden cleared the threshold of 270 Electoral College votes needed to win the White House on Saturday. He beat Trump by more than 5 million votes nationwide, as Trump became the first president in 28 years to lose his bid for re-election. Biden delivered a victory speech in Wilmington, Delaware, on Saturday, then unveiled a coronavirus task force on Monday. Traditionally, the losing candidate calls and congratulates the winner, then delivers a concession speech that seeks to unite the country. But far from cooperating in a transition, Donald Trump continues to falsely argue that he is the rightful winner and vow that his team will fight to the end in the courts of law, mounting long-shot challenges in several states. In his Fox Business Channel interview, Trump campaign advisor Jason Miller said, "We're going to go and pursue all these legal means, all the recount methods. We're going to continue exposing and investigating all of these instances of fraud or abuse and make sure the American public can have full confidence in these elections." Miller said he expected recounts in Georgia and Arizona, legal action in Michigan and Wisconsin, and sufficient evidence to challenge the outcome in Pennsylvania. The legal offensive has flopped so far, though, with judges throwing cases out of court for lack of evidence. Donald Trump's campaign released a dozen emails on Monday, seeking donations for an official election defense fund. But there was no indication that any new strategy would fare any better. In a separate interview, Tim Murtagh, the communications director of the Trump campaign, told Fox Business Channel, "We have high confidence that as the president pursues his lines of legal recourse, including the recounts in Georgia and Wisconsin at least, we do feel like there is a runway for the president to win this and win re-election." Tim Murtagh rejected reports that Trump plans to hold campaign-style rallies to push for recounts, but promised grassroots events such as boat parades to protest against Biden's victory, explaining, "People are upset. There is no evidence whatsoever of fraud in the vote count, which culminated in media networks announcing Joe Biden as the winner of the election. Trump's improbable stand against reality appeared to be splitting both the White House and the Republican Party. The president is reportedly being urged by his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, by his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and Jason Miller to keep pushing hard for recounts. The White House chief of staff, though, Mark Meadows, and senior aide, David Bossie, are said to be encouraging Trump to consider throwing in the towel." Melania Trump, the first lady, tweeted on Sunday, "The American people deserve fair elections. Every legal, not illegal, vote should be counted. We must protect our democracy with complete transparency." Donald Trump's stranglehold on the Republican Party is such that only a small number of Republicans have publicly acknowledged his defeat. Among them are the party's only living former president, George W. Bush, its defeated 2012 nominee, Mitt Romney, and two other senators, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska
and Susan Collins of Maine. According to accounts by the Washington Post, just 8 Republicans in the House of Representatives have described Joe Biden as the winner of the election. The bulk of the Republican Party has backed Donald Trump's effort to pursue legal options or have endorsed his conspiracy theories. Pat Toomey, a Republican south of Pennsylvania, told CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday, 70 million Americans voted for Donald Trump, and they and the president deserve to have this process play out. Now, I understand yesterday the media projected how this is going to end, and the media projection is probably correct, but there is a reason that we actually do the count. There was a hint, though, on Monday, that the president might bow to the inevitable when the Axios website reported that he had already told advisers he's thinking about running for president again in 2024. Donald Trump would be eligible to run again because presidents are allowed to serve 2 terms in office, which do not have to be consecutive terms. He won more than 70 million votes this year, a strong show of resilience. In 2024, he will be 78 years old, the age Joe Biden will reach this month. Donald Trump's intransigence has raised fears of a bumpy transition, with little sign of him inviting Biden to the White House in the way Barack Obama held a meeting with him shortly after his shock 2016 victory. The General Services Administration is responsible for formally recognizing Biden as president-elect, which begins the transition, but the agency's Trump-appointed administrator, Emily Murphy, has not started the process or given guidance on when she will do so. During the election, Donald Trump refused to commit to a peaceful transfer of power, and it remains unclear whether he will instruct his staff to cooperate with the incoming team, as custom demands. Jen Psaki, a Biden transition aide, tweeted, "America's national security and economic interests depend on the federal government signaling clearly and swiftly that the United States government will respect the will of the American people and engage in a smooth and peaceful transfer of power." The advisory board of the Nonpartisan Center for Presidential Transition urged the Trump administration to immediately begin the post-election transition process and the Biden team to take full advantage of the resources available under the Presidential Transition Act. Donald Trump will remain president for more than 2 months. In a sign of business as usual on Monday, 9th of November, he fired his defense secretary, Mark Esper, whilst it was revealed that his housing secretary, Ben Carson, tested positive for COVID-19 after attending a crowded election night party at the White House.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ministry.
Hundreds of protesters gathered in the Iraqi capital Baghdad on Saturday to demand U.S. troops leave the country in accordance with a parliament vote earlier this year. Get out before the missiles of the faithful ones push you out, read one of the banners at the demonstration, which took place near an entrance to the high-security green zone where the U.S. Embassy and other foreign missions are located. Others carried signs bearing the logo of the Popular Mobilization Units, better known as Al-Hashd al-Shaabi, the local Iraqi anti-terrorism forces, the only viable force against Daesh in the country. These protests came days after Iraq's anti-terror Kata'ib Hezbollah group, a faction of the country's Hashd al-Shaabi, had warned that a tougher and stronger confrontation awaits U.S. forces should they defy a timetable set for their withdrawal from the Arab country. Kata'ib spokesman Mohammed Mohyi had stressed last week that the conditional ceasefire with foreign soldiers in Iraq should be taken seriously, as the limits and conditions set by the resistance will be followed by confrontation. The Kata'ib spokesman further urged the Iraqi government to preserve the country's sovereignty and control its land and sky. Otherwise, it will be accused of collaborating and colluding with the Americans. Iraq's Harakat al-Nujaba resistance group, another faction of Hashd al-Shaabi, also warned of a malicious American plot to disintegrate the country through a soft war combined with political and religious sedition. Nujaba Secretary General Sheikh Akram al-Kaabi declared then that the United States had assassinated top Iranian anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and the Popular Mobilization Force's second-in-command Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in a bid to change the political security equation in Iraq. But the scheme was foiled by the nation's vigilance, and coming up next will be either withdrawal or direct confrontations. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Iraq's anti-terror Kata'ib Hezbollah group, a faction of the country's popular mobilization units, better known as Hashd al-Shaabi, has warned that a tougher and stronger confrontation awaits U.S. forces should they defy a timetable set for their withdrawal from the Arab country. The Iraqi resistance further warned that the next stage of the fight will soon take place, featuring new types of weapons. To discuss this issue with us from Malmo is Mr. Firas Ali, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Firas. Now, Iraq's Kata'ib Hezbollah warned U.S. occupation soldiers in Iraq about taking any hostile measures against the Iraqi people or the Iraqi resistance groups for that matter, vowing to maybe escalate the fight if necessary with, quote, new and improved weaponry. Now, this is a very important message. However, is this message for the current new U.S. administration in the United States of America, or is this rather a strict message to the current government led by Khamenei in Iraq, because they're absolutely putting them in the front line between them and the Americans? So to whom is this message sent to?
I think this message is probably directed to both the Iraqi government and the Trump administration. Regarding the message to the Trump administration, it's probably in case of this bad loser president has thoughts about any military adventures in Iraq now when he has lost the elections. And regarding the message to the Iraqi government, it's the resistance here telling the government that it won't accept any attacks like those who happened last year against the PMF bases in Iraq, and that it's necessary for the government to speed up the withdrawal of the U.S. forces from Iraq. An interesting point here, Marwa, as you pointed out, it's the message about improved weaponry. It's a message from the resistance to the U.S. forces that the resistance and the PMF has not been idle during this year waiting for the withdrawal of the U.S. forces. They have improved their weaponry, and they will use them in case they need it.
Well, Firas, the Kata'ib spokesman, he urged the Iraqi government last week to preserve the country's sovereignty and control also the land and sky of Iraq. Otherwise, it will be accused of collaborating and colluding with the American occupation soldiers inside of Iraq. Now, this means it's a serious threat in Iraq, in a country that is already volatile. It has a lot of divisions within it, politically, security-wise, even sectarian-wise. Are we looking ahead towards a possible
possible civil war maybe in Iraq if the government keeps up its stance against the resistance in favor of the U.S. occupation?
I don't think so, Marwa, because any enforced action against the PMF from the government is also an action against the Iraqi security apparatus. It's not possible. One of the reasons is that the second biggest paramilitary alliance in Iraq, the Fatah Alliance, is basically a protector of the PMF. And some of the resistance group have their political wing in the Fatah Alliance. And also, we have to see that in the message of the spokesman, he's really telling, as we mentioned earlier, the Iraqi government that we won't have a summer like 2019. Mm-hmm. The Iraqi government can't excuse itself by delaying the withdrawal from of the U.S. forces in Iraq. It's a responsibility to control the air and lands, and if that doesn't happen, the resistance won't be bound by any political solution for the withdrawal. They will have the free fire against the U.S. forces in case of any attacks.
Well, what's interesting, though, Firas, is that at the beginning of the year when Kademi, or months ago when Kademi took office, he was presented by a uniform for the popular mobilization units, and he was lauded by the popular mobilization factions. But now it seems that the level of threats and the level of concern is rising among both the factions and the government. Is there a specific, maybe, breaking point that might happen that would put both sides in a confrontation?
It could be like that, because when the parliament gave confidence to the Kademi administration, the Fatah Alliance also voted for it. They gave him a chance, because mm-hmm. nobody in Iraq wants a country without a government. It won't function, especially in this time with the problem of the U.S. forces, the pandemic, and so on. But since then, Kademi has slowly but very standby, he has come closer to the U.S. position regarding the PMF. We have the attack on the Kitab Hezbollah, mm-hmm. the raid on the Kitab Hezbollah base in Baghdad, which I think the Kitab Hezbollah handled very good, because they showed a form of strategic patience and didn't fall into the trap of strife between the army and the resistance.
Mm-hmm. This is very interesting, though, that the Americans may not have assessed the capabilities of the Iraqi resistance groups, since they did not engage in battle yet against them. But they did have targeted the PMU military bases, whether inside of Iraq or on the border with Syria, and they made sure that the Iraqi government harassed especially Kata'ib Hezbollah factions within the popular mobilization forces when we saw them arresting Kata'ib Hezbollah members a couple of months back as well. What if the U.S. just maintains this kind of rhetoric? Where can you see Iraq then?
Well, firstly, I don't think the Americans will be able to harm the PMF or the resistance only by harsh rhetoric, because the resistance is not made of glass. Secondly, the U.S. forces has a disadvantage in Iraq. Like in any form of sports, they are the away team. This is local ground. This is home ground for the resistance. It's the resistance people, and it has legitimate demands which the people support. So the resistance will be in the upper hand here in face of any confrontation between them and the U.S. forces. You know, Marwa, recently some reports have been circulated in media about the U.S. intentions to target the resistance leaders, Khazali and someone else, Hadi al-Amri it was, I think. I think that is also part of the U.S. propaganda machine to scare the resistance movement, but mm-hmm. they're trying to scare people who doesn't have fear in their vocabulary. Mm-hmm. I think the Iraqi resistance are fully aware of the U.S. intentions, and those it won't fall into this trap that the U.S. are trying to get them into.
Last month, we had members of the Iraqi Resistance Coordination Commission publishing a statement suggesting that they would halt their military operations against the U.S. occupation troops in Iraq, including rocket attacks, providing that Washington does not persist in maintaining illegal presence in the Arab country. What if U.S. troops move to Kurdistan and maybe maintain their warmongering behavior against the popular mobilization forces from Kurdistan, Iraq? What options do you think that the PMU have?
Well, firstly, Iraqi Kurdistan is still part of Iraq as a country, and any withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq, it would also include Iraqi Kurdistan. Mm-hmm. Secondly, according to the Iraqi Constitution, Article 110, it is the federal government in Baghdad who are responsible for the security of Iraq. It includes the borders, the lands, and all that goes within the national security policy of the country. So withdrawal from Iraq would also mean withdrawal from the northern region of Iraq. But in case of that doesn't happen and the U.S. forces move their bases to the northern part of the country, well, the federal government in Iraq has several options in handling this issue. One of them is the budget issue, because a lot of the money for the local budget in northern Iraq comes from Baghdad. Mm. And there are probably other alternatives as well for the government. And regardless of how the government will react, the U.S. would be very foolish if they think that they are safer up there if they take any actions against the PMF or the resistance in Iraq, because certainly the bases in northern Iraq are within the fire range of the resistance forces, especially if the surprises here, which the spokesmen are hinting to, the improved weaponry will be get to use in that matter.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Firas Ali, political commentator, for joining us from Malmo to talk about the possible confrontation that might happen between the Iraqi resistance and the U.S. if the U.S. does not leave Iraq and withdraw its troops. I want to thank you for your contribution. Now, please stay tuned with us. We will talk more about Palestine in the next segment. Israeli bulldozers and diggers demolished Palestinian village of Khirbet Humsa last week, leaving 74 people, including 41 minors, homeless. An advocacy group says that more than 800 Palestinians have been left homeless by Israeli demolitions so far this year, after this single target by Israeli demolition displaced dozens in the occupied West Bank. Israel ethnically cleansing the West Bank in this following report. Ethnic cleansing is what the Israeli regime continues to do against the native Palestinians in the occupied territories. The demolition operation, which displaced dozens of Palestinian citizens in the occupied West Bank last week, was conducted under the Israeli annexation and settlement expansion schemes. Late on Tuesday, November 3rd, as the world was busy with the U.S. elections 2020, the Israeli regime's bulldozers, heavily guarded by soldiers, razed to the ground a Bedouin village in the district of Tubas in the Jordan Valley, leaving dozens of inhabitants of the village homeless, half of whom were children. The bulldozers proceeded to demolish 70 civilian properties, including storerooms and residential tents, that sheltered 11 families composed of 60 people, including 41 children. According to a report by the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, the tented homes, animal shelters, latrines, and solar panels were among the structures that had been razed in the area. The demolitions were preceded by the confiscation of several Palestinian vehicles and other possessions. The Israeli occupation soldiers also raided Palestinian homes in the area and confiscated money and precious items from local residents. Now tell me, how is this not piracy and war crimes? Tell me, how can the Palestinians stop these illegal colonial pirates when every time this happens, they turn to the international community and UN bodies to uphold their legal and moral duties in order to urgently intervene to curb Israel's ongoing crimes against the Palestinian population? This large-scale demolition confirms once again that nothing will stop Israel from maintaining its trend of confiscations and demolitions. Well, nothing except the ultimate act of revolt, a new blood of resistance that would initiate a full-fledged intifada. A new spirit of revolution like that of Hero Maher al-Akhras, who fought for his freedom through an empty stomach, leading to a victory after 103 days of hunger strike. Maher's steadfastness and commitment to struggle with his very life on the line continue to inspire all those around the world who support the Palestinian people and their cause of return and liberation and their current fight against ethnic cleansing. Now with us from Ramallah to discuss this issue is Dr. Nimr Saad, academic and political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Saad. Now, Dr. Saad, a total of 74 people were displaced, more than half of which were minors, as Israeli bulldozers and diggers demolished houses, sheds used as livestock enclosures, portable toilets, water containers, and solar panels, on top of confiscating vehicles and tractors belonging to the Palestinian residents who are now homeless in the occupied West Bank. What is the Palestinian Authority waiting for to take firm action against Israel?
Well, we know that Israel are trying to evacuate the Jordan Valley from its 46 communities, Bedouin communities, like Humsa, which had happened just a few days ago. But before that, it was also Fasayel and other areas, which is subjected to the Israeli measures of evacuation. This is a kind of an ethnic cleansing in the area. Now, for the Palestinian Authority, they are trying to do something about it. But remember that this area is sea area, which is under, according to Oslo Agreement, under the Israeli jurisdiction. It means that the Palestinian Authority officially can't do anything. So it was led to some of the, let me say, organizations and popular committees who are trying to stand with Humsa and the area in general. Now they are providing them with all the equipments they needed, new tents, and try to rebuild the whole area again. But still, this is not enough. Anyway, the Palestinian Authority also is trying to contact the international community in so many ways, through the United Nations and through the embassies, in order to put this issue in front of the international community to take measures. And especially that Belgium, for instance, was the first one to protest, and they are demanding Israel to pay them, the Belgium, compensation, because the Belgium have helped this area of Humsa. However, what we are thinking now that not only the Palestinian Authority, but I think also there should be a kind of popular resistance and popular movement in the area to support the area, exactly the same like what happened in El Khan El Ahmar, when the Palestinian stayed there all day and night for a long period to prevent the demolition of that village also.
Well, Dr. Saad, by all means, what Israel is doing is falling under the aspect of ethnic cleansing again. And this is a crime punishable by international law. Yet the international community, especially the UN, seems to be completely out of the picture. Why is that?
They were always out of the picture. The problem is not that they don't know what the Israeli are doing, and let alone the United Nations. What about the European Union, for instance, who had a special treaty with Israel? According to the European Union articles, they said that we deal with the countries in accordance to their human rights violation and human rights record. And they know exactly that the Israeli are violating not only the human rights but all kind of laws, international laws, in this respect, but they don't do anything at all, because by the end of the day they have some special relationship with America, and they are more interested in these relationships and the economic relationships with America more than the human rights in Palestine, more than the international law in Palestine. So neither the United Nations nor the European Union will do anything apart from just condemnation or trying to tell the Israeli in a way or another that you shouldn't do that. But I don't think that they are going to take any measure which will be effective. In this coming week or 2 weeks from now, on the memory of the Palestinian solidarity with the Palestinian people on the 29th of November, there will be some sessions in the United Nations, and these things are going to be addressed. But unfortunately, as I said, even if they they have taken resolutions in the General Assembly or even in the other circles in the United Nations, the Israelis are not going to comply. By the end of the day, the Israelis are backed by the Americans and the Americans supporting them. They will prevent any resolution by the Security Council with the veto, and they will help Israeli. And we have so many resolutions in the United Nations on the level of the General Assembly, but the Israeli not complying with these resolutions. We need more, if you like, pressure on Israel and on America and on the international community.
This brings us to a very important question here, because as you said, the wiping of a whole community at once is extremely rare in the world except in Palestine, and it seems that Israel is making use of the fact that everyone's attention is elsewhere. It's on the U.S. Results, the U.S. elections 2020 results, but the attention of the Palestinians is there, exactly inside Palestine. How do you think the Palestinian political and resistance factions will respond to such an ethnic cleansing, especially since the UN bodies are in a different place right now?
Well, now the Palestinians are trying to do this reconciliation and to put one strategy. I believe personally, and most of the Palestinians do believe, that we need to go into our own resistance, to ourselves, to start a real resistance, not only a peaceful, as they put it always, peaceful and popular, but also all kind of resistance should be allowed to the Palestinians. We are in such a position that not only the United Nations, but the whole world community failed us. They see the violations, they see the ethnic cleansing, which is continuing since 1948 till today, and in so many different ways, but it's still there, not only in the West Bank, but also in Jerusalem, also in Golan Heights. We have to understand, and the international community have to understand, that Israel is a state of violence and also racist against everyone, and they are not going to have at any time any relationship with the Palestinians.